how this got started, at least as a Louisiana Appleseed Project. Mm-hmm. Although, funny enough, we were at the same law firm when all of this started. I was an attorney on loan to Louisiana Appleseed from Adams and Reese, his law firm, and mine. At the time, we were partners there, law partners. And but anyway, the firm heard about National Appleseed and said, why isn't there one here? And it was 2 years post-Katrina, and I think that's when systemic issues really started to bubble up to the surface in Louisiana, because it took recovery. Our recovery program took a really long time to roll out, because it was the first and the biggest in, you know, the country's history that needed to take place. And so it did take them a while to get started, but I think that's when the air property problem really became more than obvious to communities that had not previously had to deal with. They didn't need the paperwork in their name. They really didn't. Because in Louisiana, and this is where Malcolm knows way more about the technicalities of it, but in Louisiana, you can inherit property. You inherit the property as soon as the person dies. You, through the civil law system, you've inherited the property. But the paperwork still needs to reflect that inheritance. And so that's where the snag is. That even though you're an heir and you became an heir when the person passed, it still isn't technically, well, it's just not merchantable. You can't get recovery funds. You can't
bank loans.
Bank loans, like, no way. And now it's starting to affect people and their tax assessments too, because it's a complicated thing. But like, a new law was passed last session to where tax assessors are going to receive death notices now, monthly, from the Office of Vital Statistics or Records. And so now, I know at least legal aid advocates and attorneys are concerned that that move is going to really hurt the low-income population, especially those who haven't opened successions, haven't even had time maybe to open a succession from the person who passed away. If the homestead exemption is yanked, which probably will be now a lot sooner than it has been in the past, it'll really hurt, I think, some low-income families, especially if they accumulate taxes and then a tax bill goes out and they say, well, we thought the house was under the homestead exemption. We haven't opened a succession. So that's kind of an emerging issue that we're keeping, Louisiana Appleseed's keeping our eyes on, that Malcolm probably doesn't know about, but if he did, he'd be so intrigued. But anyway, sorry if that is kind of off topic, but it is about property ownership and low income and low wealth families, for sure.
Exactly. So I guess mostly I wanted to talk to you about how these efforts all developed and kind of the story of it, because it's mostly kind of the story of kind of implementing all these reforms. So you said that Appleseed in Louisiana was founded after the hurricane.
There were some early efforts to get it started. In fact, when National Appleseed was founded in the mid to late 90s, I guess, the concept was to, and this is so punny, but like, to sow the seeds of justice in all 50 states. And so I think that the folks, the Harvard Law School graduates who got together and decided that that was going to be like their reunion class gift to the school, was to form this nonprofit that addressed systemic reform, not just pro bono case by case. So I think what they did was they contacted folks that they knew in all the states and tried to kind of get one started. So they did contact Lynn Luker, an attorney at the time at Adams and Reese, the same firm that I was talking about a minute ago, and she was very interested. Adams and Reese actually, on a pro bono basis in 1997, helped craft the 501c3 filings and articles of incorporation. So Louisiana Appleseed was technically born in 1997. But had no staff. It was all just very well-intentioned lawyers. And the concept, I have to say, of policy reform, even now, is a little bit different than it is in, say, D.C., Chicago, New York, like more progressive places, probably. And I don't mean to be too I'm from the South. I'm from New Orleans. I don't mean to speak disparagingly, but it's just, I've spent some time in D.C., and it was hard, I think, making the transition, especially when I did switch over to Appleseed to try to explain what we do. Solving problems at the root cause, people start to understand that. We have bad laws. They need to change. People understand that, for sure. So anyway, so that's kind of, so 1997 is when it tried to get started. Did not start. They even had a board of directors that was statewide. They would meet, from what I understand, every few months by conference call and really try to get going, and it just never did. So then right before Katrina, they hired their first executive director. Her name is Monica Taylor. She's now in the state AG's office. She was only on for a few months until then Katrina hit. And after that, it just, the world just was on its head. Because Katrina was in 05, and then 07 is when Adams and Reese, which, again, it's a coincidence that Lynn Luker did the Articles of Incorporation, all the early papers, But anyway, that's when Adams and Reese heard about Texas Appleseed through to a client and said, why don't we have one here? So called National Appleseed and said, why don't we have one here? Well, we've tried a little bit, but we've never been able to hire a full-time staff person, preferably a lawyer. And just kind of, I think they wanted to try it something different. And so they asked Adams and Reese if they'd be willing to incubate Louisiana Appleseed for a couple of years. And so they approached me, the firm approached me and said, would you be interested in taking on this role just for a year? Mm-hmm. You would have to put your practice on hold, but you would, your entire job would be to help get this nonprofit started, and then we're going to spin it off. And I was like, I love the idea of that. I had done a lot of pro bono work in my practice, and the one-on-one, the case-by-case. And as a class action litigator, I never really felt like I should be handling divorces, adoptions, kids who've been taken from their families, because if you ask me about class certification, you know, and the tobacco lawsuits, I could tell you about that. But it's just to represent a kid in court, it just was not my thing. Mm. And so that's part of why Appleseed appealed to me when I first heard about it, because I was like, gosh, as a big firm lawyer, which in New Orleans is so different than a big firm lawyer somewhere else, but like, I would have really enjoyed the idea of like research, analysis, advocacy. I can do that.
Yeah.
I can do that all day. That's what I do for these folks. Taking a kid to court to explain why the mom shouldn't have her tonight. That's really hard. That's a hard
same
stuff,
thing.
Right?
Agree,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the tough stuff. Like this, you know. But anyway, so they asked me if I wanted to do it, and I was like, absolutely yes. And I was at a time in my personal life where it really made a ton of sense. Like, I just had 3 kids in 18 months, and one of them set of twins. But anyway, it was just, personally, I was like, this is a great time for me to try something different, but also kind of be available to my family a little more than normal. So anyway, so I did that for a year. 1 year turned into 2 years. Mm-hmm. So in 07 and 08 is when it was incubated at Adams and Reese, and 09 is when I think Louisiana Appleseed was strong enough to hire an executive director full-time. And so the board kind of came to me, of Louisiana Appleseed that we had formed, said, we want to hire you, but you really have to leave Adams and Reese. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about it a long and hard and decided to leave. And so we left in 2009, we left, and I keep pointing this way because they're in One Shell Square, the tall white building.
Yeah.
We left there and moved to where we are now.
Okay.
So I left the firm, I guess, 8 years ago to do this full-time. And that's where we were. I was at Adams and Reese, and so was Malcolm, 2 floors apart. But when I, like in my first week of work or so as Louisiana Appleseed's interim executive director or whatever, I got a phone call from a secretary on Malcolm's floor on 44. I was on 46. And she said, Christy, I've been doing a lot of volunteer work in the Lower Ninth Ward to try to help redevelop. I've been working with Habitat for Humanity and Baptist Community Ministries. And there's this problem over and over. We keep going door to door, and people keep saying, I can't get rebuilding money because I don't have the right papers.
Wow.
And so we start talking about it, and she was like, if somebody could fix that, it would be great. So then I called a friend at Legal Aid, who headed up the Legal Aid office here in New Orleans, the Legal Services Corporation. And so I called him and said, hey, this issue. And he's like, oh, if Appleseed could fix that, that would be great. He's like, it's been around forever. Huh. And so he's like, it's not just this storm, but it's worse now than it ever was, meaning the problem,
the urgency
existence
of dealing with
is already
that.
There. Yeah. Yeah, but it was like a Katrina revealed problem for us as a community, and not just in New Orleans, elsewhere too, but mostly here in New Orleans. And so anyway, so I talked to him and then sent out a firm-wide email and said, hey, you know, as you know, we've just launched this nonprofit. This issue's come up. Who knows about it? And then Malcolm responded. So I think his recollection of how it transpired is slightly different, which is funny. But regardless of how the details and the emails and whatever, he and I started working on how do we fix this at the root cause. And so Malcolm, I mean, he literally probably did or didn't tell you this, but literally wrote like the horn book on real estate law in Louisiana. I mean, like it's Myers on real estate. I mean, he just knows so much and has a wealth of knowledge. He's been a professor at Tulane. He had been in practice though for decades. And he knows so much. And so he, right off the bat, took a look at the law, and I think he talked to Mark, the legal aid attorney that I called.
Mark Moreau?
Moreau.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of started talking about the law is too complicated. It's way outdated. It needs to be, it's too expensive. So it needs to be less complicated, easier and cheaper. That's just kind of how we explain it to the community. That's what we started to figure out is how can we do this? And so Malcolm took a look and was like, I think that we should form a study committee at the state legislative level, but pick who's on the committee, not the person, but the entity. So like we should have somebody there from the Martinet Society. We should have somebody there from the Law Institute. We should have somebody there from Tulane Law School, from Loyola Law School, from Legal Services Corporations, from, so we kind of came up with a list of who should who should really be at the table to talk about this.
Yeah.
And then that resolution passed, and we met as a group, and just kind of the legislation went from there. And so Malcolm, we kind of went back each year. Now I'm glossing and skipping over tons, but like we kind of went back, once we made the major changes in 09 or 10, we would go back each year and kind of try to broaden, cast the net a bit wider of who could use this expedited process to get clear title. Mm. And so I think that that's kind of what we did for a while. And then this past session, and this is when Malcolm decided to, understandably, to retire from his position as a volunteer, although he will always be, you know, we called him for lots of advice along the way this year. But we engaged Patty McMurray, an attorney at Baker Donaldson in Baton Rouge, to take the lead to make an even bigger change to the law. And so that's what we did this session. And it's I think it's a huge, I mean, it's going to help a lot of low wealth families in Louisiana, but I think it's going to help a lot of middle class families as well get clear title, people who don't already have clear title.
And, can you tell me a bit more about these recent reforms?
I can. Yeah, I wasn't sure how like detailed you wanted me to go or not, but Malcolm, again, and Patty are the true experts. They're the real estate attorneys that can walk you through. This is what this word means. This is what this word.
Yeah.
For me, again, this was never my field of practice, but basically during that first legislative move, Louisiana used to allow for an affidavit, an heirship affidavit, to be used on movable property.
Okay.
Meaning like a car, a boat, something that literally moves, can move. Anyway, there was like a dollar amount that was $50,000 or less, and it had to be movable. And if you met those two requirements, you could use an affidavit to quickly prove heirship and like not open a succession. Like, let's just prove heirship. Now you got the papers you need, go.
Mm-hmm.
You got the title to your boat, great, like done. But what Malcolm did was he looked at the process and said, how can we make the affidavit, how can we make it be used for immovable property for the first time? Houses, funeral plots, like land.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we proposed after this kind of study committee met, is that the heirship affidavit process be expanded to include immovable property for the first time, and then to up the $50,000 or less value to $75,000 or less.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, like a lot more people could use it because now it included immovable property, and then more, we just kind of made an adjustment, especially because the law hadn't been touched in years, from the $50,000 to the $75,000 or less. So at 70, it's the estate has to be valued, or at the time, had to be valued at $75,000 or less at the time of the decedent's death,
okay,
when the person passed away. So then we went back, and that was well received. I mean, people all over the state were just, when he probably told you this, but when we went, Malcolm and I were just amazed when we went to the legislature how we had described it kind of as a New Orleans specific problem, but figured it happened elsewhere. But when we went to the legislature, there were so many legislators from rural communities elsewhere in Louisiana who said, we have this problem. I have this problem in my own family. You know, we need to fix this law.
And not just related to the hurricanes. That's just like all kinds of...
Yeah, not just related to the hurricanes. I mean, tornadoes in North Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that when, you know, there's maybe a farm was wiped out, but grandpa died a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? And so anyway, and it doesn't have to just be disaster related.
Right,
but
exactly,
again, that's kind of when people open their eyes and say, wow, it wasn't a problem until it's a problem. And so anyway, we went back maybe the next year or the following year to the legislature. We had heard that the use of the affidavit was going really well. There were concerns of fraud. Every now and then people would kind of ask questions like, how do you know people aren't going to lie? You know, how do you know? They can just, in theory, go to even a notary public and get this notarized and then put it in the mortgage office. How do you know that they're not going to lie? But we didn't, I mean, there was a waiting period and a way to challenge that if you really wanted to, like if another heir wanted to challenge. But we have still to this day not heard of any fraudulent activity when it comes to people trying to, you know, pull one over on cousin Eddie or whatever. Like, no, it seems to be working really well. Is it flawless? No way. I'm sure it's not. But like, I think that that was a concern that was somehow didn't become a problem.
Okay.
But anyway, we went back a year or two later to the legislature and told them the affidavit was going great. Thanks so much for your support. It passed unanimously in both houses.
Mm-hmm.
But we asked them to include, to forget about the value of the estate if the person passed away 25 years or more. So if the person died that long ago, chances are heirs would have come forward, you know, kind of in that time period, that even in families who the value is 75 or more. $75,000 or more for the value of these. So, and I don't recall how that change came about. I don't recall who Malcolm heard from in the community that that needed to happen, but the legislature said yes, and so we made that tweak. So then time goes on, and every now and then, I guess we would go back to the legislature and propose something, like that instead of the state of Louisiana having to, before they issue recovery funds, instead of them having to have a full-blown succession done or even a succession affidavit, if somebody's living in the house and can prove that they've been living in the house for, I think it's like 3 years, that they've been maintaining the house, then we actually had the legislature pass something that says that the state of Louisiana can still disperse recovery funds to that person in order to rebuild and repair the home. In other words, like the affidavit, the succession process shouldn't stop the state from going ahead and getting that money out the door. They'll probably have a lot of even Katrina-related money and funds that haven't been distributed.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of seems like a good idea at the time. It kind of backfired on us a little bit in the Baton Rouge flooding that just happened last year. So, and I can talk more about that in a minute if you want me to. But basically, so we've made changes, like little changes through the years. The major change that we made this year was in response to actually the Baton Rouge flooding. There was just huge flooding last year in the Baton Rouge area and other, I think 19 other parishes as well, but especially in Baton Rouge. And so we kind of took another look at the affidavit, like, okay, we haven't done anything on it in a while. How can we make some changes so that more people can use it to get recovery money, especially from FEMA, because federal guidelines are a bit tighter when it comes to successions. So how can we change it so that the net is cast even wider so that more people can use the affidavit process? And so we changed the law to, instead of the value of the estate being $5,000 or less, we changed it to $125,000 or less.
Okay.
So now a family can use the affidavit process for a succession if the decedent's portion of the estate is valued at $125,000 or less, and we made this change too, or if the person died 25 years. No, it used to be 25 years, now it's 20 years
before.
Okay. So if the person died 20 years ago, you don't have to look at the value of the estate and do all that analysis. You can just use the affidavit process.
So this must cover the vast majority of the estates in the state, right?
I think it does.
Yeah.
Because, and I don't know that for a fact, but I think it must, because it's the decedent's portion. So suppose you have a grandma and a grandpa who owned a house together, and it was part of the community. Then, and grandpa died, and grandma never did anything about it. And so grandma just lived there, and then grandma died, and grandchild lived there, and then, and but still needs to, like, now to access recovery money, needs to open a succession for both of them. Well, now it's 125 plus 125. So if the value of the estate is $250,000 or less, then they can use the affidavit process. Or if grandma and grandpa died 20 years ago or more, then they can use the affidavit. So it really does open up this expedited process a lot. I think for a lot of people. And I think we're going to start to hear, hopefully, about how great. That just went into effect this summer, so we haven't quite gotten a chance to hear back other than legal aid attorneys in Baton Rouge who are using it all the time.
Okay.
So.
Are there any kind of further tweaks that you guys are thinking about, or are you going to wait and see? Okay.
Not to that, because I think we went big on this past time. And our main opposition is the Louisiana Clerks of Court. The clerks, if somebody qualifies for the affidavit procedure, they don't have to open a full-blown succession in court. They can go through an affidavit procedure, even get a notary, hopefully a lawyer, somebody to do the document with them and notarize it, and then they can go file it in the conveyance office, the recordation office. And there's a fee, but it's small. It's probably $40, $50. If the person doesn't qualify for the affidavit and has to open a full-blown succession, then they have to go to civil district court, like right over there, walk in, and pay a lot of filing fees. And so you can imagine that the clerks of court who are used to getting those filing fees want more people in this line than that line. Because that, unfortunately, and I don't think it's fair to the clerks, that's how our clerks' offices are funded in Louisiana, is through fines and fees, which ends up hurting the community in the end. So the clerks, both in 2010 and this past time, were the only people who showed up to potentially vote. We asked the legislature to vote it down, but we were able to reach a compromise with them. And last time, the compromise was that, last time meaning the 2009-10, I can't remember which year, we wanted estates valued at $100,000 or less to be able to use the affidavit. And the compromise was $75,000 or less. Mm-hmm. This time we went for $150,000 and the compromise was $125,000. And then they wanted to put in, the clerks asked the committee to do this, and they said yes, we didn't oppose it. But they put in some language that in the successions that do go to court, since more are going to be in this line now, in the mm-hmm. conveyance office line, for the ones that do go to court, that the clerks can charge, they can make up their own charges or fees or something okay. for that process.
Because those are going to be more difficult anyway. Or more.
Yeah, the more complex cases yeah. are going to go to court anyway now. And so that does kind of make some sense. And so that's why we didn't oppose it, because we were like, well, okay. Plus mm-hmm. we wanted to help yeah. everybody, but especially the folks that can use the affidavit process now. Mm.
How do you think you avoided any other kind of political opposition? Was that kind of strategizing on your part, or kind of keeping a wide net, or whatever?
A African-American Democratic state senator to be our legislative champion. Mm-hmm. He was very good. He retired, that's why I say was, but from the legislature, but he was very good at building consensus, both with Republican and Democratic senators and even House members. I think the approach that we took was a very, like, no-nonsense approach. Like, how can you say no almost? Especially because I think working with people on the front end, I think within the Appleseed world, it always helps to bring in who you think your worst opposition is and talk to them and say why. You know, why? Well, tell us your needs, the clerks. Tell us what the problem is. Well, the problem is it's unjust how we're funded by the state. And so I would love somehow if Appleseed could, and we are looking into it, we just got some funding from the Annie E. Casey Foundation to look into how our courts are funded. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, so we wanted to work with them.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, well, how can we work with you? Unjust or just, that this is the court fee structure. So how can we work with you? What do you need? So I think that kind of helped, is like talking to folks ahead of time. I think that study committee, I think if we had to do it all over again, I would have said, let's do that study committee again before this legislative attempt, even though it was perfectly executed, flawless, no opposition once it got to the floor, not even in committee once we reached the compromise that we reached with the clerks. I think that that's a good way to sell it to the legislators. Look, we've met with these 18 groups, mm-hmm. gotten feedback from all of them, and it was an open meeting. It wasn't just the 18 groups when mm-hmm. we did it the first time. Let's have them all in the room. Like, let's have everybody in the room and talk about what can we live with. This is a problem. We're proposing a solution. What can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's a, and Craig will talk about this, I'm sure, the Uniform Partition Act.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask you all
about
this. Yeah,
that's nationwide.
So Louisiana hasn't signed on to that, and it's kind of one of the few states around here.
Yeah.
Is that just because the partition sales are less of an issue here, or just a little?
That's Malcolm's, it's still an issue, but Malcolm's view, and we had Malcolm look at it, because we're like, who better to look at the uniform law and then Louisiana's existing laws than Malcolm?
Yeah.
And so he did, and he's of the opinion, I don't speak for him, but what he told us at the time is that he felt like the laws that we had on the books, especially being a civilian, like a civil law state,
yeah.
the laws that we had on the books, he felt like were not too bad.
Okay.
But what we did add in was some notice provisions, some other. So we did go to the legislature on partition one year.
Okay.
And we did propose some changes that were accepted and went through well. I mean, I don't remember huge opposition. Mm-hmm. As far as the Uniform Act, I know that people from outside of Louisiana would love to see it passed here. Because, you know, it's a good thing. I think it's a very good thing.
Yeah.
As to whether it happens here or not, we're not opposed to it. If somebody wants to propose it, and supposedly Chris, there's a professor at Southern Law who supposedly does want to go the Law Institute route and try to put the Uniform Act through the Law Institute. And I think that if they're going to do that, that's the best way to do it,
mm-hmm.
is go through the Law Institute, let it go through the study process, and see what fits in the civilian system and what doesn't,
okay.
which isn't so different than the common law, honestly, these days. But, like, I think that that's a really good, and mm-hmm. if they want Appleseed's help, that's great. Like, I think we'd be interested in that communication, but at the same time, like, I don't think, we haven't felt that we're the ones to lead the charge when it comes to the Uniform
okay.
Act, at least not right now.
Yeah.
Maybe in the future.
And then so the reforms you mentioned that did about notice and the other things, so you said mm-hmm. that was kind of inspired by the Uniform Act?
Yeah,
or,
definitely.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's an answer in itself, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, the HP, the Air Property Retention Coalition,
yes.
I think is the name of it.
Under John
Pollock.
Talking to him on Monday too, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, when we became kind of part of that group, we just started hearing and learning more about the Uniform Act, and I know Georgia Appleseed had great success in doing it. Texas I know Texas passed it. I feel like Texas apple seed might have been a little bit involved. I don't know that they led the charge on it, but yeah, I mean, so many southern states have done it now that, I mean, granted, they're not civil law states, but it doesn't matter. But I do think that that's one thing that the Law Institute takes as one of their duties, is to kind of stay as true to the civil law and that heritage as we can, but understanding the need for progress, and that it's 2017. So maybe they'll look at it with that lens and then figure out kind of what, now if Malcolm came to us, it wouldn't just have to be Malcolm, but if somebody came to us and said, like, no, this really, the Uniform Act is, you know, really, we need to do it here. I mean, I guess we think about it, but nobody's done that. So.
One thing I really want to know more about is about collaboration between the different apple seeds, especially in this whole kind of process. Because I know right after Katrina, we had the report, the After the Storm report, whatever, and that was done by several.
Year after.
So that was like several different apple seeds? Okay. So that's,
It was Texas apple seed, and then I know
Georgia, I think, right?
Yeah, I think Georgia helped, and then I don't think D.C. helped, but a lot of Washington, D.C.-based firms helped, because that's where National Apple Seed is. It's where their office is. But anyway, so that, and honestly, I think that probably, since it predates me, I probably don't remember enough to credit that with partially why our center was reborn, and partially why that air property issue was identified, even though I recall it being the phone call that I got from the secretary. I'm sure I, at that point, looked at the report and, you know, was kind of trying to probably put together our project portfolio based on, here are the issues that still exist. Because that would have been, we were a year after that report came out. So it was like, that report was 1 year after Katrina. Louisiana Appleseed came to be about a year, maybe missing my time frame, but after report. So that's been, but the collaboration, we, as a network, the Appleseed Network, got funding from Kellogg. National Appleseed did, and they distributed it to some centers to have a Gulf Coast recovery program.
Okay.
And so that's when I think the centers probably worked the closest, especially on air property, because it was Texas Appleseed, Louisiana Appleseed, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina to a certain extent, since it's somewhat coastal. But really, this was Gulf Coast recovery. Mm-hmm. And so those were the states that participated. And I mean, we had a staff time fully a staffer, National Appleseed had a staffer fully devoted to that. Most of the work had to do with air property. Some had to do with access to financial institutions for Latinos and African American population here. But mostly it was air property and title. And so I was on that call, we met a lot by phone. And Maddie was from Texas, and me. And then Allison Tiller was the Gulf Coast recovery person at the time. She was the National Appleseed employee. She actually sat here in Louisiana, though, with me, which was nice. So, I felt really plugged into that project in particular. And then eventually National Appleseed, once the funding had expired from Kellogg, she came to work as our program director with Louisiana Appleseed.
Okay.
So it was nice for me to have, a staffer, ready to go.
So,
and she worked with us, too. But, even while she was with the National Appleseed, technically being paid by them, she still worked with my center a ton. So, anyway, so I forgot why I got
Okay, so you guys were, so there was both the Earth Property Retention Coalition, which would have kind of weekly phone calls or whatever, and then there's the Appleseed had its own
Gulf Coast Recovery, which was more than just air property, but it was, we ended up talking about that almost all the time, because all of us were working on it, because it was such a problem for all of us, for us, Katrina and Rita, for Texas, Ike and Dolly, for, Alabama, Katrina, and, people moving over there, just kind of disaster upon disaster. And then Georgia really is focused on the rural, I think, aspect of air property.
Yeah.
They've done well doing that.
Do you know, is there any reason in particular why Mississippi is kind of left out? Is it just because it's kind of a smaller state?
Isn't it interesting? I know, because there's no Mississippi Appleseed.
Yeah.
And when I've asked that question in the past, I've been told that because the Mississippi Center for Justice has such a strong presence in Mississippi, that maybe the thinking, at least, maybe, I don't know if it's in Mississippi or outside of Mississippi, is that they just do such a good job on the direct services, policy, advocacy, that maybe they're fulfilling, some needs there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I've never heard talk about, because it is kind of strange, because we kind of go that, and then not Florida.
I guess they have their own issues, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know.
And how much do you collaborate with, I guess, Southeast Louisiana Legal Services?
How much do we collaborate? Oh, tons. Tons and tons. Yeah, tons and tons. Like, I was emailing Laura Tuggle, their executive director today.
I'm going to talk to her tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love her. Yeah. But I was just, I love working with her. And Mark Moreau before her. But but she and I have definitely, like, our organizations. I mean, we now apply for grants together. Southeast Louisiana Legal Services being the direct services component, Appleseed being policy advocacy and the community outreach. So, like, after we changed the law, going into the community with SLLS to say, here's the problem, here's how we fixed it, here's your lawyer.
Okay, great.
So, like,
yeah, because that's, I guess I wanted to know more about the awareness raising component of this, because I guess that's a big part of this, right? I
mean, yeah, it is.
Sure,
because
people understand this change. Okay.
I know, yeah. So the people, because there's no point in changing a law if nobody knows about it. So we've been trying to educate lawyers, like have CLEs and trying to continuing legal education classes, try to like get them to know more so they can talk to their clients about it. But then also just direct outreach to the community, like through faith-based organizations, through maybe cultural and community organizations, like just kind of try community centers, just all sorts of. We have an outreach coordinator in Baton Rouge. He's almost full-time. He is full-time right now on this project alone. Floodproof is the name of the Baton Rouge Title Care and Collaborative with us, SLLS, Southern Law School, LSU Law School, Baton Rouge Bar Association. It's funded by the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, a community foundation there. But the money is really from Kellogg. It's just Graff is kind of the overseer. But so that's an example of where we applied for a grant together and got it, and now we're doing work there. Before Laura's time, when Mark was around, we applied together to the Greater New Orleans Foundation for a two-year collaborative having to do with title and air property, specific to New Orleans. And so that's kind of where I think we really started to get kind of our feet wet with this, and it was during around the time of the policy changes at the Capitol. And then now we're just starting, Laura and I, as of November 1st, so we're kind of like just starting, a project for SLLS and Appleseed in two coastal parishes, in Terrebonne and Lafourche parishes, like people who, it's not necessarily disaster related, but they are very disaster prone, and that's about sustainability in communities. And the Greater New Orleans Foundation funded that from a sustainability grant pool. So we're starting that work. It's, yeah. We've already started it technically, but we're kind of still ramping up. So
the process for, like, you know, the average person or the target community here would be, you know, education, and then getting people to peer title, and then hopefully making airship affidavit after clearing the title, and then that, okay.
Like getting to get the process. The affidavit. Well, the affidavit, we'll get them clear title.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Let's see. Was there anything else? And then, so you did mention this, the Baton Rouge floods, you said there was a bit of a backlash about,
kind of like an unintended consequence. I think sometimes, like at Appleseed, we need to look at kind of what are some of the intended consequences and the benefits, the pros and cons of those, mostly pros, and then unintended consequences. And one of the unintended consequences of the law that I mentioned, it doesn't have a ton to do with the reforms that we talked about in 09 and 10, or even the one this session itself. But rather, it's the statute that Malcolm kind of had the idea for after working with the state to try to understand why funds were so delayed and getting out to folks. And they were like, well, if we could just release the funds to the person living in the house, at least the person who's been living in the house, at least they could get started on the repairs while the succession progresses, either through affidavit or court. And so we loved the idea of doing that, and we went to the legislature, and they saw the reason, you know, like, yes, okay, that's great, let's get that done. And then that was post-Katrina. So we were trying to be a little bit, like, anticipating, like, before the next disaster, let's see if we can streamline the process to help especially low-wealth communities who don't have their own money or access to credit or lines of credit to try to get their house back. Let's see if we can kind of expedite the process for them. What I would like to see, what we didn't put in there is a requirement that the person initiate the succession process or something. I feel like we kind of unintentionally put a Band-Aid on the problem and said, okay, let's get those recovery funds out. But then that might just be enough. Like, a family might be like, oh, well, we got the money to repair the roof and to get going. We'll handle the succession another day.
So they didn't clear the title.
They didn't clear the title.
Yeah.
And so in the States, like, we love it. We can get the money to the people who need it out the door faster in a very legal, statutory way, and we, again, applaud that.
Yeah.
We're behind it initially, along with lots of other people, not just us. But I think now we're seeing that post-flooding in Baton Rouge last year, that the state is relying very heavily on the statute, saying, well, they don't have to have clear title. we're going to release the funds according to the statute.
Mm.
And legal aid, like Laura and I have talked about, but the families still need clear title, like in order to build wealth and assets and not be so vulnerable mm-hmm. if another disaster strikes. So now we're trying to figure out like whether something needs to be done there, whether we can do anything with the law as it stands that would help both objectives, that help the state disperse funds in a I don't want to say regulated, in a logical, methodical, correct, legal way,
yeah.
but then also have the families actually get clear title somehow.
Okay.
So that they, yeah. So I would like something that meets both objectives.
Okay, that makes sense.
But we don't have that yet, so we're just kind of like toying with the idea.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's in the process stage. Hmm.
Yeah, no, like unintended consequence. Like, I don't know. We didn't think about that.
Yeah. Are there kind of any kind of metrics you use for kind of measuring results here? Or
no, but if you can tell us, if somebody can help us with that, that would be good. We went to, Laura Tuggle and I went to a meeting at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. The Ayers Property Conference.
Yeah, did you go to that or no? Or
I wasn't working on that at this point, but I'm trying to keep together. I'm trying to meet with everyone who...
Yeah, we went to that and I did a little presentation on some of the work that we've done in Louisiana. And we talked to, I feel like it was a... it was an academic department within the University of Georgia that was kind of looking at how can that metrics. And we were like, that would be great because since we have in Louisiana, I'm not sure what other places do, we have a decentralized court system. Meaning each court kind of can make up its own, not its own rules, and same with the clerks of court. That's decentralized too. So like they can make up their own rules about fines and fees. So anyway, so it's hard. My point is, we don't know how many times the affidavit is used every year. We don't have a way to track that. Like, we don't have a way to track that. So I would love some kind of metrics to tell us, other than anecdotal, you know, attorneys from Shreveport saying, thank you so much. This has helped so many of my clients, you know, you know, and kind of hearing back from especially legal aid attorneys, but then also practicing attorneys, that this is such a great process. We love it. Or, hey, can you tweak this next time? But I wish that there was a way for us. And I know Georgia somehow figured out a way to at least measure how bad the air property problem was in Georgia.
Mm. We're trying to do, like, certain counties. Like,
yeah, yeah. It's hard. But Malcolm and I talked about that early on. Like, do we need to quantify the problem? And he felt like, no, it's a problem.
Yeah.
Like, do we need to say, well, this many houses in this district, if the legislature already sees it's a problem and they're already willing to work with us on changing the problem, then we probably don't need the statistics to convince a policymaker or just to know for our own benefit, you know? And then and it's not like legal aid, the LSCs can't then solicit clients. So if we did figure out, like, 50 houses on this block are air property and we know which ones they are, then it's not like you can, it's not like the legal aid folks can then go say, I mean, it's just their solicitation rules. I mean, we don't have them because we don't represent people.
Right.
But it's just, I don't know.
Yeah. That's kind of tragic that you can't see the impact
No, and funders would love to know that. I mean, we can, when we partner, the good news is when we do partner with SLLS, we can, so right now in the Baton Rouge floodproof and the project in Baton Rouge, because we partner with SLLS, we know that at least within their office, at least within their world, they are helping, I think, 305 families get clear title. The economic benefit is almost at $5 million to that community. So those are statistics that, like, Appleseed, we, like, thrive on because those are the only metrics we have is when we work with direct services. It's just, with policy and advocacy work, it's just so hard to quantify.
So you're saying what you'd have to do is talk to each parish individually and figure out its own rules and get them to try to
tell them how many affidavits were filed last year. Like, if we really wanted to see how impactful the law is that we had this past session, we would be able to look, in an ideal world, we would say, how many affidavits were filed before the change in 2009?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then between 2009 and 2017, how many were filed?
Yeah.
How many people used the affidavit? Between 2017 and, I don't know, some other time in the future, how many more people used it because of the bump from $75,000 to $125,000? I would love to know that.
So you'd have to get the clerks to do it all at work, and they're very busy, and
they got a lot going on. It would be tough to ask them to cooperate. I mean, they might cooperate, but I'm saying, like, it would be a hard ask for us because there's so many other administrative duties that they have, and really, it would just be for our own curiosity or to report back to funders.
Yeah,
you know, so like, in theory, it would help us help more people.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I would love to know, though. I really would. And I'm sure Malcolm would, too. I mean, he estimates, you know, I don't even know what his latest estimate is on how many people he thinks have used the affidavit.
Okay.
Do you say, like, in the... Definitely in the thousands.
Thousands. It was, yeah. I went down. It was like, yeah. 20,000, 30,000 or something like that? Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Crazy.
But yeah. It does seem like each state I talk to that they have the same problem. Like, even kind of measuring your spot for you, right? Nobody knows how much. Yeah.
But yeah, I would love to be able to do that.
Huh. Great. Well, you already answered all my questions.
Yeah,
I
talked your ear off.
You know, that was wonderful. It's great.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Yeah, is there anything else I should be aware of, or any of the kind of frontiers of various property issues here? I mean, it seems like you guys have a pretty good handle on everything. I mean,
I hope so. I think that one challenge that we found, and Laura and I have talked about this a lot, Laura Tuggle and I, in the Katrina Rita world down here, by the time we kind of got to this issue, I think some people were, like, the psychological effects of the storms were still around, but people were actually, like, living maybe in Houston or Atlanta or in a relative's house, but they had, like, food, clothing, shelter, their kids were in schools, that kind of stuff. In the post-Baton Rouge flooding world of last year, we were, like, ready. We were ready to go. And so was the Baton Rouge Area Foundation with this money from Kellogg, ready to go, like, ready to clear titles in the community. But they weren't ready. Like, the community members weren't ready because they were still, like, I'm sorry, I'm living in a hotel, and, like, I need to eat my food for tonight and, like, find my kids in school, and, like, I can't think about clear title to my property, whatever that is. You know, like, I can't think about that today. I got to do other stuff. And so, like, the psychological effects, I feel like even when the community is ready to respond, the legal community, the philanthropic community, sometimes it's the actual person who has the need. Huh. They might not be ready to take that particular step yet.
Wow.
So that's been kind of tough when it comes to outreach for us, because we're, like, we have Jaron, our outreach coordinator in Baton Rouge, who, and I actually went to Canvas with him one time. I was like, well, take me to one of the flood-impacted communities. Let's drop these floodproof flyers off at every door, talk to the people who are there. And he's like, absolutely. And so four of us went, and so many of the houses are not occupied. Mm. So many in the worst devastated places, there's nobody there. There's nobody to talk to. And so that's been a challenge for us, is that, you know, even some of the faith-based communities, like in New Orleans, when we reached out through some of the, especially in the African-American community, some of the preachers and ministers, in Baton Rouge, when we tried that same route to outreach, the churches themselves were devastated and flooded. Mm. So it's like, they weren't still in water, but I'm saying, like, it was hard to locate the minister because he or she was not only dealing with probably their own home, but, like, also the church structure, trying to get it back up and running for the community. And so it was just kind of, there's been some, like, stops and starts where we're kind of ready to go, but the community's not, or, like, we're ready to do door-to-door outreach, but we realize that a lot of the houses are vacant still.
Mm.
So it's just kind of strange. But we have found, as an organization, Texas, I think, has a different perspective on this. We've found, and Laura will probably say this too, FEMA's been a lot easier to work with this time than they were after Katrina. I think it was just all so new and crazy and unexpected. And they've been, like, easier to work with in the sense that we've, even though they have a lot of turnover and they tend to send people to the latest disaster, like Florida, Texas, whatever, Alabama, we have case managers that we can talk to, people on staff at FEMA that are down here that we can talk to regularly to say, hey, you know, we need to get these flyers out. Are y'all canvassing soon? Or, like, just kind of working together. And even information sharing. Like, we were able to fill out a public records request to ask for the amount and the names of the families that have been denied FEMA assistance because of home ownership issues. So because we don't solicit clients, because we don't have any clients, because we're a policy and advocacy organization, we were able to then, FEMA has this provision that if you're trying to fill an unmet need and you're a nonprofit, that they will release the homeowner's information. And so anyway, we were able to reach out individually to, like, 1,000 people who we knew had been denied federal assistance because of home ownership issues. And so that's, for the first time, we were like, wow, this is at least 1,000 families that most likely have air property problems that we can just reach out to directly and say, you have a problem. You've been denied FEMA assistance. We know you have, in a friendly way.
Yeah, right.
We know you've been denied FEMA assistance. We're here to help. We don't cost any money. You know, kind of, here are our friends, SLS.
Yeah.
If you want to reach out to them. And they've gotten, I think, a positive response from that.
Okay. Do you think there's anything that could be done at the federal level? I mean, you're talking about better responses at FEMA. But is there anything else that to help ameliorate heirs' property issues? I mean, obviously, it's a very state, local
issue. I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a good question, because Malcolm has a son-in-law who's a congressman now from Texas, out of Texas.
Oh, really?
That's funny, yeah. so he's talked about it. Like, how can we, you know, is there something we can change at the national level? And I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. I mean, maybe folks with more of, like, a national lens, like Thomas Mitchell or even John Pollock, would have very concrete thoughts on that. But Louisiana, sitting here, I can't think of how.
Okay, great.
So